down this cliff, go left down the cliff, yeah. Left, and then just tumble for a while, and then you should be there.
My truth is the truth that you will never understand.
Private ownership is one single individual giving green light. Doesn't that tell you that your system is more akin to authoritarian dictatorship?
If now we had a king, I thought we're an autonomous collective.
What the heck is a deed? How come he can buy our house when it's our house and we live there?
Just when these American citizens needed their rights the most, their government took them away. The rights aren't rights if someone could take them away.
Today, half every man in a straitjacket. To leave a country is like breaking out of jail. And to enter a country is like going through the eye of a needle.
I don't know if you've noticed, but our two-party system is a bowl of shit looking in the mirror at itself.
Academy essentially opens up policing to the citizens. It's a pretty anarchic idea for an 80s movie.
Not only go on strike, but we need to fire the bosses. This whole you getting paid more, doing less work thing, it's not working out, Steve.
All right, welcome back. Went on auto for a minute as my computer got unplugged, and I'm back, though I'm still waiting for my stories to load up on my... Okay, I'm going to have to wing it. My computer got unplugged. Welcome, welcome. This is the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, live in the studio, a very chilly studio. Just an introduction, I suppose. This is the Three Left Show. Think of it as your left-wing reading hour, multi-tendency, not stuck in one particular dogma. But otherwise, Happy New Year, everybody. I don't have anything memorized as far as quips. Suppose I could rant about how well the Yellow Jackets are doing, you know, using forklifts as the new pitchforks, breaking into ministry and busting some cars up. There was some news. The government shutdown, thinking about kind of a reading from this, you know, it was a historical history textbook of first-hand accounts. And one first-hand account was from a 20-something worker, a woman, in Weimar Republic, Germany. This is 1920s, before the rise of the Nazis. And she was part of a socialist organization, but because of her long hours and you know, she was certainly aware and woke and all that, and that's why she was part of a socialist group. But she recounts how her activities were mostly just a kind of bicycling group, leisure, and, you know, and how, like, I want a more socialist world, a more fair, you know, where I do not have to work 6 days a week, 12-hour days, doing rich people's laundry. But there it was, and sometimes it feels that way, like, you know, us radicals or activists, we have our projects. But meanwhile, there's this narrative that, like, well, Trump, with the shutdown, there seems to be this hand-wringing about him declaring a state of emergency. And then Dan Carlin of Common Sense Podcast puts it, the turn-switch dictatorship, that all the rules and the infrastructure's in place for a first-rate dictatorship, and it's all just there, sitting there. All the tools needed for repression, the police state, the prison system. It's all there. It just requires just the flip of a switch, declaring of a state of emergency. Now, liberals and conservatives alike seem to be okay with all of this buildup. Sometimes there were some concerns, but as far as the voting record of Congress and Senate was concerned, there wasn't really any opposition to it, the building of this turnkey dictatorship. So there it is. How do we resist it? How do we just... I mean, it just starts with noncompliance, I suppose, should it even happen. To me, it seems like hand-wringing. It's not really going to go down that way. Or the ruling class, is going to make it seem like it's just business as usual. In fact, an end of the crisis, the government shut down. People can get their food stamps again. File their tax returns and get those rebates, all those tax credits that our economy seems to depend on. All my stories are loaded now, thankfully. So now I can turn to my reading series for this week. I have a number of different pieces to go through. Not quite, you know, in the moment news. Some weeks will be like that, and other weeks I'm more the companion listening series for those who do follow the news week to week or have other types of media just to help us understand it, maybe put things in perspective, and see a bigger picture as well as seeing alternatives and other options, especially if you are just watching the corporate news cycle and how they talk about it. Everyone knows it's bunk, it's bull, and they know something's wrong about it. But what else is there? I just have a TV, or I just listen to the radio, and this is why I'm here. So I'm going to go, I like trying to connect everything that I'm reading together, or at least have some kind of momentum, a theme of sorts. And so I came from a secularist background as far as, you know, I'm a strict materialist. Anything supernatural is just something we don't fully understand yet. Doesn't mean it's not some real phenomenon, but we just don't understand it yet. So I'm not going to comment or have any strong or even moderate beliefs about it. So in that context, I'm going to read something from The Friendly Atheist. The Friendly Atheist, as opposed to The Mean Atheist, which is a stereotype purported by the dogmatic religious right. And so the story is, a year after giving atheism a try, former pastor Ryan Bell admits he doesn't think God exists. Now, this is a follow-up story from something, I guess it was only a year ago, feels like forever. Oh, there's a problem. This story is from 2014, so this is from a while ago. But it's an example. Why did it just come up on my Facebook feed? Oh, that Facebook feed. Nothing disconnects you from reality better than, I guess. In the year 2013, a pastor said he was going to spend a year living as an atheist. He wanted to explore his own spirituality, his own beliefs. Many pastors are actually on the fence when it comes to how strong their beliefs in God are, as some people who actually study the Bible, who study their religion, and are very introspective about it, if they are such. And many, you know, the good pastors are. And in this one, so I'm going to start from reading it, but this is written by Hemant Mehta. He is The Friendly Atheist. This is a blog. So almost a year ago, Ryan Bell, professor and former, and by the way, I'm reading this because it's an example of changing one's worldview. And that it isn't a switch. It isn't something that just, aha, I mean, maybe we all have aha moments, epiphanies, as they're called. But it's also a slower process. And here's an example of that, especially when it's a dramatic one. Now, it was almost a year ago, Ryan Bell, professor and former pastor of a Seventh-day Adventist church, announced that he would try on atheism and live as if there was no God for 12 months. I didn't agree with his methodology at the time. I felt like he was just exploring an alternative option, not actually becoming an atheist. Hell, most atheists don't even read books by Richard Dawkins or attend gatherings with other non-believers. So how would doing those things give Bell a real sense of what being an atheist was like? You know, to be a minority, to have ugly stereotypes about you. But he got a taste of what being an atheist was like much sooner than expected. Less than a week after announcing his experiment, Bell was fired from his Christian employer at Azusa Pacific University and the Fuller Theological Seminary because, according to Bell, quote, they simply feel they cannot have me as part of the faculty while I am in this year-long process. So just stating that he wanted to explore. Readers of this site came through in a big way and helped raise more than $27,000 for his family as they coped with the sudden unemployment. Fortunately, that is the way we have to deal with sudden unemployment. Too bad we don't have a real social safety net. That year has come to an end. So what has Bell decided about God? This is 2014. In an NPR story today, he told reporter Andrew Raff that atheism just makes more sense to him now. I've looked at the majority of the arguments that I've been able to find for the existence of God, and on the question of God's existence or not, I have to say I don't find there is to be a convincing case in my view. I don't think that God exists. I think that makes the most sense of the evidence that I have in my experience, but I don't think that's necessarily the most interesting thing about me. Reaction from the blogger, wow. So over the past year, Bell critically analyzed his belief, the beliefs he grew up with and professed from the pulpit, and realized that the evidence just didn't support it. If only more people had the courage to put their faith. And this isn't just about in the context of feeling centered to church, the importance of spirituality, which I define through extensive reading, a feeling of wholeness, being connected to the world at large, other people, nature, you know, reconnecting with nature, going out and having a nature walk, you know, everyone connects to the wholeness, feeling whole and being connected. As an antidote to our economic system, our jobs, the situations we're put in that make us feel disconnected, alienated, as it is. So Bell isn't necessarily as enthusiastic atheist, but neither are millions of other Americans out there. He also doesn't claim to be certain about his atheism, but that's also on par with most atheists, usually called soft atheism. We're open to evidence for God's existence, we just don't think there is any. To be sure, I wouldn't have supported Bell either way. I would have supported Bell either way. That's called solidarity. Even if he came to the conclusion that Christianity still rang true for him, I would have applauded the fact that he bothered questioning his beliefs at all. He took something that he at one time felt incredibly certain about and put it under a microscope, knowing that there was a chance he wouldn't like what he saw. Most people fear that. They would never do what he did. It's like jumping out of a plane without knowing if there's a parachute on you. Bell found a parachute, even if it looked nothing like what he imagined. He says, I think before I wanted a closer relationship to God, and today I just want a closer relationship with reality, Bell says. Bell has a new job, by the way, putting his humanism in action. A newfound humanism. He's working with a group called People Assisting the Homeless, acronym PAF. He worked with them when he was a pastor, or he had that connection, but now it's just more evidence that you can still be good without God. Yeah, not much more to say about that. So just an introduction to changing one's worldview. And on that note, I'm going to read a piece written by, of all people, Pamela Anderson, who is pretty much a Marxist now, a revolutionary person. Someone I'm now going to admire, sells vegan products, I guess, and he's created a foundation. And kind of in the same style that Teen Vogue is somehow the most radical regular magazine, a popular magazine out there, because they will publish articles written by anarchists and socialists just explaining the 101 for the teens. And that's something that is very, very important. Just to enlarge the reality tunnels that are built around us. If you just watch one TV channel, that's a reality tunnel. So, as I was saying, I'm going to read a piece from Pamela Anderson, of all people. But, hey, I think when it comes to being woke, we accept everyone. And to lay out some ideological reminder, all politics are identity politics. It is just a matter of how many identities you identify with or acknowledge and associate with yourself and others. Not just to say, I'm a woman, I'm just going to be in the Women's March, but also say, oh, there's also black women, there's also First Nation women, there's foreign women, we should care about them too, and maybe stop all the bombing. So this is called Revolt, Don't React, written on December 18th, not too long ago. And I'm reading from Pamela Anderson's blog, PamelaAndersonFoundation.org. In his famous poem, The Solution, Bertolt Brecht joked that the people had forfeited the confidence of the government, and it would be easier for the government to dissolve the people and elect another. This has given me food for thought. I am in the USA for a few days and following what is going on here. Not much has changed. The USA still has the best universities in the world, but terrible schools. Many children graduate illiterate. There is a huge increase in addiction to pharmaceuticals. More hyperactivity. No free media. Parentheses, I do not consider propaganda-filled media to be free. Huge division among racial and ethnic lines, and brief, a country in crisis. 2 years down the line of the current administration, the Democrats and their mainstream media friends are still obsessing about Russia's alleged role in the last presidential election. The recent reports by the Senate Intelligence Committee claim that Russia allegedly targeted African-American voters and, quote, exploited racial tensions and feelings of alienation. I wonder where those come from. They still naively believe that American voters were brainwashed by a foreign power to elect the president. And They make it sound like as if the current political camps are divided among a line of good and bad folk. On one side is the camp of civility and values. On the other side, that of frustration and hatred. So superficial. I find it absurd and pathetic. Because they still do not get it. This country is where it is because of the system the Democrats and the media have helped to build. Instead of dissolving the system, they would rather dissolve the people. This is especially clear in the South, the belly of the beast. I would love to tour the South. I'm curious about this part of the U.S. that allegedly loves guns and Trump. The liberals see these people as a basket of deplorables. They accuse them of all kinds of things, of being backwards, of having to stay still, do not stand out, don't cause trouble, and be in by 10 p.m. attitude. I look around, and in so many countries, I see one common denominator, a revolt of the periphery. From the election of Trump as president to Brexit, Catalonia, the yellow vests, and I wonder if it is because capitalism at the periphery is always more drastic, more cruel. People in so many places do not feel represented by, or by the, or their politicians. They know that it doesn't really matter who is at they actually vote for because nothing will much change in their lives. Because the real power does not sit in the ballot box. It sits elsewhere. Power is in the global hands of a big business and financial capital. And into this post-democracy world enter the so-called populace, or as some call it, the strongman politics. Why are they so successful? Is it because they have managed to raise awareness of the unprivileged? To shine a light on the story of those underdogs who have lived through conditions created by predatory capitalism? The story of people who have awful jobs in production lines and factories and supermarkets? People who believe that hard work will eventually make their lives and the lives of their children better? Strongman politicians do not offer them alternatives. They merely respond to their feelings of exclusion. They give the people back their pride, or so is portrayed. But in fact, all they do is give them back their illusion of pride. They offer them emotion, feelings over facts, as it were. It makes sense to me why the periphery vote the way they do. The status quo is made impossible for them to dream of a different future, a better one. So they are forced to idealize the past. It also makes sense to me why they do not respond to calls for solidarity. Solidarity cannot be ordered. The impoverished middle and working classes who cannot afford much feel forced to defend what little they have left, and so they become radicalized through fear, the fear of loss. And when the rich and the privileged and the state and the banks are already so powerful and wealthy that they direct their anger towards the weaker groups of society, towards refugees and minorities. And so it makes sense, but it is also very worrying. Worrying because these days the people in the USA and elsewhere, do not have a huge amount of choice. They have to choose between neoliberals, aka deluded folk who offer repetition of the same decades-long economic mess, or the strongmen. However, the problem is not the populist or the strongman politician, which merge in some cases. The problem is the economy and the economic inequality. The problem is neoliberalism, aka capitalism as it is today. I want to help people to become revolutionaries in training. Now to the point. I read a recent interview of Adam Curtis in The Economist. Curtis is a British documentary maker who talks about a sense of doom and how nothing ever changes. I agree with everything he says. We must stop believing that the current system is set in stone with an inability to change. We must stop believing that what we have is the best possible system out there. We must stop claiming that the other side is bad or confused or brainwashed by fake news. Instead, we must do more than just wave a flag of tolerance and civility. We must work towards it, offering a stronger political story and a stronger action, I would add. We must fight against those who not only hold but hang on to the power and wealth with relentless tenacity. We must stand against neoliberalism and its global and regional institutions. We must offer an alternative, democratic, and socially, yes, just society. One devoid of social democratic compromises, especially with big business. I have set up a new foundation to support activists and other revolutionaries. It's called Tenure. We are planning radically great things. But more should be done. There are those in academia who are offering an alternative for our economy. There is a new manifesto of French economists. Very interesting. And the future will be either revolutionary or reactionary. Holding on to power. I also want to gather other artists and creative people, smart people, to think big, think ambitious. Let's do our manifesto for the revolutionary future and ponder how to put it into practice. I want to gather people who are able to accurately describe society, and then we can change it. I have so many ideas. Pamela Anderson has ideas, people. So do I. It depends on us, and there are enough resources to build better alternatives. I want to build the revolutionary future and dissolve the system, not the people. Are you with me? All the love, Pamela. Okay, so we're at 10:30. This is a reminder. I'm your host, Dan Platt. I was just reading a piece by Pamela Anderson. I don't know how long she's had these politics, but she's definitely, I'm with her. And let's see if I can bring up some of those stories I have, because they're going to be a little bit more. Now, someone who's kind of maybe one foot in the mainstream, one foot not, to people who are entirely outside of it. I want to expound on revolutionary practice. And then the best way to see it is not in America, of course, but in other countries with robust revolutionary parties or parties that profess such things. At this very moment, I do not have all the facts in front of me, but there is a strike of many hundreds of thousands of workers in India. Communist leaders have been arrested. That was the headline. But there are massive strikes going on. And many other movements in other countries inspired by the Yellow Vests rebelling against the same thing. A neoliberalism that cuts taxes for the rich and then raises fees for the poor or the workers. So where to go through next? I think I will jump to another interview from Verso Books. In my last episode, I covered one of the same, those French academics who have very interesting thoughts. I think I'll go through the outline version because I do have some of those notes. So this is a Verso interview with Alain Babalu, and it's titled, We Are at the New Beginning of Marxist Thought. Quite a bold statement as such, because, hey, you, the listener, may not even know what the old Marxist thought was. My housekeeping on the air. So he points out there's a new vision for struggle. An answer to one question is to point out that to be revolutionary is not to be totalitarian. I think that's a neoliberal, a neoconservative conceit. It's part of their narrative that's repeated on cable news ad nauseum. To want revolution, to want a change, a total change of government, is to be totalitarian, authoritarian. You have to do everything by the barrel of a gun, as if our current government doesn't also do everything with the threat of force. So then it recognizing that, it kind of becomes a question of, as Pamela Anderson puts it, is it going to be revolutionary or is it going to be reactionary? Who is going to be the victim of violence, but what form is that violence going to take? If it's reactionary, it's coming in the form of a very ordered form of violence, which takes the form of camps on the border, dead children in cold boxes, if you haven't heard of those stories yet. You should. And just general malaise of violence from our prison system to the brutal cops against African Americans, # Black Lives Matter, but also the ignoring of many other injustices by our so-called justice system. The turnkey dictatorship, as it were, should Trump declare martial law and all the things that entails. An orderly reactionary violence that perhaps if you are middle class will not touch you very much, but certainly leads to genocide of others for the sake of the stability of the pseudo-majority, as it were. Or instead, usually with left-wing revolutionary violence, is much more, it's a matter of being undisciplined, but it is an undisciplined settling of accounts. The French Revolution, for example, they're just more of an indiscriminate chomping off of heads and putting people against the wall and sending people to labor camps. It's undisciplined. It's sometimes random, but it's usually a matter of, you know, mob justice is still a pseudo form of justice. It's just coming about in a way that is, the word is undisciplined. And then it's hard to know. Like, well, if it's undisciplined, it's unorderly, it could be me. But that's where consciousness comes in. Are you a landlord? Are you someone who would be a target of such violence should the poor rise up and start actually hurting those who have wronged them? Then you need to ask, have I wronged anyone lately? How could I be wronging someone right now? And that can get you to greater consciousness. And so it is a question in these times of crisis and future crises. What would we rather have? Reactionary violence of genocide and police states? Or the left-wing violence, revolutionary violence, that is perhaps undisciplined, but always lower in the death count? And especially as we are conscious of past mistakes. For example, in Mao's China, the Cultural Revolution, as it's called, the purges of Stalin, you know, the examples that are thrown out of the millions and billions of dead, which are not actually millions. It's more like thousands. And that's something that he points out in this. But he points out that also, like, there's kind of a triad of, and that's what he means by new Marxist thought, is that you have movements that express democratic will and are fair and represent people's needs. You have a party, political organization that represents a vision and direction and the means of taking power or holding it. And then you have the state itself, that regardless of the future, we're going to still have states, which are defined as institutions that hold a monopoly on violence. And then we can choose to not use that monopoly of violence at all. That is eventually the goal, to not need violence. And if you do have movements that represent democratic will and plan the economy, which is way more efficient and fair, then violence will not be necessary. And that requires cooperation between groups that, you know, at this moment have different interests. Reactionaries have an interest to hold on to the power they have, which is more power than others do. And the choice they have is to share it, or that power will be taken from them in a, as put it, undisciplined manner. So if you can't tell the kind of direction I'm going here, first I talk about using an anecdote about changing one's worldview dramatically based on the evidence. Then I talk using a former celebrity, a notable person who has changed their ideas dramatically about and has a revolutionary politics. Then I, with an interview with a French academic, I kind of make the case for revolutionary politics and the actual practice of it, results as they are, and how they can be better than the 20th century, or the possibilities. And now I'm going to go through an article from the Monthly Review. This is a revolutionary left-wing magazine of sorts, Monthly Review. And now from the perspective of someone who was a revolutionary, or is, a Bolivarian, meaning a revolutionary in Venezuela, and someone who, you know, won the revolution, as it were, installed a new government, one that's just a social democracy, and is being choked financially. I'm not going to go through all the counterfactuals of Venezuela. Let's just start from the perspective that, on the whole, it has helped more people than it has hurt, and the majority of their economy is still private. So it's not about socialism versus capitalism in this, but I'm just going from a revolution versus status quo reaction, because the status quo cannot hold. It cannot hold. It is failing on every level, and we all feel it. So now it is a question, reaction or revolution? That is the position we're going for. So this is an article, a dispatch as it were. It's called Biplab, Communist Party of Nepal on the Move, a dispatch by a far-flung Bolivarian. So this is a Venezuelan activist traveling Nepal and reporting on party politics there. So let's just dive into it. I'll let it stand on its own, maybe comment if I feel like it needs it. A common belief is that the project of scientific socialism grows best on arid soil, barren of all myth. It is in this modern materialistic wasteland, free from all idols, that the gray owl of Marxist ideology will begin its slow flight. So this is a kind of part of that old Marxist thought that the French guy is kind of expounding upon, that it is changing. Because whatever rational arguments exist in favor of this view, it simply doesn't hold up to history. In fact, socialist projects thrive most fully in contexts where ideals such as hope, loyalty, and even faith still survive. In certain situations, even the scientific nature of socialism can be converted into a very powerful myth. If you have an uncritical attitude towards modernity, a socialist movement trading in cult-like ideals or myths will seem simply naive or even retrograde. However, as a Bolivari Marxist and Latin American by choice, I'm aware that myths such as those surrounding Che Guevara and Hugo Chavez, and of course Simon Bolivar, are not so much liabilities as assets for left movements. It's simply the complacency of global capitalist culture that makes us mistake jadedness for wisdom and confuse intellectual acuity with the inability to assume the commitments, the attitudes, and the beliefs that could be the first fruits of a communist project. In Nepal, where I am currently traveling to learn from its left movements, nothing could better exemplify this kind of spiritually rich social base than that of the communist movement led by Netra Bikram Chiad, or Biplav, nickname. Militants of the movement, which consolidated itself as a party some 5 years ago, wear their commitments on their sleeve. In that sense, they have a great deal in common with Chavismo, which is the movement around Hugo Chavez, in its best moment. Just as we used to defy the world, saying, Chavez no se va, they do the same, affirming that communism will win. And just like us in the beginning, they cannot get enough of the color red. Militants even use red pens, while at important events and rallies, they replace Hindu tikkas, the forehead marks, with colored powder, with giant red communist swaths as their leader on their leaders' brows. In Latin America, such practices or rites, insofar as they are not purely rational, are often called misica. A term refers to a political movement's sometimes ritualistic expressions of immaterial values, such as morale, confidence, loyalty, and hope. Is this a recent Latin American invention? Far from it. In fact, misiquita was quite present among the original Bolsheviks. Remember that Lenin and friends danced in their Petersburg apartments when strikes went well, and that the old Lenin danced again when the October Revolution surpassed the 72-day lifespan of the Paris Commune, another revolution in the 19th century. Both Lars Lee and China Miéville have done important work recovering the role of fantasy and faith among Russia's early communists. Mystica, like mystical, importance for the global left in crisis today cannot be overestimated. The political panorama in Nepal makes this especially obvious, since most of the revolutionary tendencies here trade in the same general ideas, all of them based on Marx, Lenin, Mao, MLM, not to be confused with multi-level marketing, pyramid schemes, as it is. That being so, how can one party or current distinguish itself? What would make one tendency better or more authentic than the others? The short answer is that it is mostly by demonstrating commitment, honesty, and coherence in thought and action that one communist movement or current, in any kind of movement, in Nepal could stand out from its rivals. This is indeed Biplav communist movement's strong suit, excision of the main Maoist movement. They call themselves simply Communist Party of Nepal. The name is barely distinguishable from that of the ruling Nepal Communist Party, founded by one-time supreme leader Pushka Kamal Dalha. Yet Biplav's party claims to be the real thing and aspires to bring the ruling party down. So I'm going to point out, if you probably don't know, that Nepal currently is in fact governed by a communist party. They took power about 5-6 years ago. So Biplav's movement is a reaction to their taking power and not quite being communist enough, as it goes on to explain. a story about Biplav, who is half Mangar and hails from the country's underdeveloped west, sheds light on what his party offers. Half a decade ago, before his group split off, the then 40-something leader was participating in the annual celebration of the beginning of the People's War. The event was to take place in the North Mountain villages of Tabang, the original Maoist headquarters, and getting there involved a serious uphill climb. Biplav found the ascent easy, but a senior cadre called Badal, who was walking with him, got out of breath and stopped to rest. Biplav joked that Badal about how he found going uphill difficult and suggested that maybe a new unflagging generation should take over in the movement. The senior leader became morose and silent. Biplav's reputation is huge these days and growing, although he makes few public appearances. It is evident that he exercises a special draw on Nepal's youth and the youth in spirit, or the young in spirit. This is hardly surprising, since Biplav's party's core message is that of the great project that the Nepali nation once struggled for is not dead, the hope of radical change, for which tens of thousands of his countrymen sacrificed life and limb, will not be traded for 30 pieces of Kathmandu silver. Another powerful idea that Biplav projects, perhaps it is the most powerful revolutionary myth of all time, is that he and his party are on the move, insurgent against power. The party has declared its vocation to seize state power, even if they admit that the time may not be now. Meaning that both militants and masses know that the die is cast. Sooner or later, everyone will have to decide if they are part of this rising tide. This is also what drew people to Chavez. The attraction was based not solely on a rational assessment of the ideas, but also on the belief that those ideas could and would become a reality. Call it a revolutionary wager. For those of us who sensed it, it was both a challenge and an invitation. Last week, I went to a major rally that Biplav's party organized in Kathmandu. It lasted the whole day. From about 10 a.m. on, waves and waves of red marchers began to fill the long streets to the east of the city's centrally located park. The high spirits of the marchers, who were giving vivas to scientific socialism, contrasted sharply with the boredom of the black-clad riot police lulling on the margins with their laifas and guns. By midday, the streets seemed full to bursting with scarlet marchers. Then, after a brief pause, twice as many more arrived, and in even higher spirits. In truth, the whole event felt electric, and the militants' enthusiasm was highly contagious. A month before, I met with the movement's main spokesperson, Prakanda, in the party's Kathmandu headquarters. At my request, he gave me a detailed explanation of the party's current program and strategy. Their analysis is that the regime installed by the ruling Communist Party is simply a form of comprador parliamentism, as they called it, a political system underpinned by the favoring Nepal's importing bourgeoisie, meaning business owners, corporations. Faced with this situation, which amounts to a betrayal of the original Maoist project, there is no option but to stage a new revolution, a unified people's revolution. The new revolution will be guided by an updated Marx-Lenin-Mao thought and will result in a state in which workers, peasants, and middle classes together exercise power. The above is a radically abbreviated summary of the meeting and went on for over an hour. It was an encounter that moved me profoundly. But more than the contents of the presentation, what won me over was his total conviction and generous desire to see me and all others take part in that movement and contribute to developing its program, what it's going to do. Throughout the meeting with his cadre, whose role as spokesperson was landed him repeatedly in prison this year, I felt that the quality of the relationship and the ethics of the communist fraternity was always in the forefront. Meeting with him and other party militants, some of whom I have come to know well, has made me painfully aware that in the Chavista movement, we have lost touch with many of these same qualities. Indeed, it's precisely for that reason that some of us began a search about a year ago for what we call a refinte morale, best translated as an ethical example that guides us. The idea is that since the original moral reference, Hugo Chavez, died, or was assassinated some 5 years ago, a new one is needed. Is this search a good idea? Yes. From what I have seen in Nepal, I am inclined to be skeptical. I am now led to believe that once a movement such as Chavismo begins such a search, it has already strayed very far from the path. That's because Nepal's Britpov tendency demonstrates how an ethical spirit that permeates everything and is not merely based on a moral referent is really the sine qua non for a meaningful revolutionary movement. It is this spirit, reaching far beyond mere ideology and program, that is a defining mark of the movement that, in my view, most plausibly fights for communism in today's Nepal. So what he's saying there in his conclusion is it's not enough to just have one person as your moral example. You need an underlying fundamental principle and value. So he's saying that this movement has a solidarity and a fraternity, a sense and a practice of inclusion that brings people in, versus putting someone up on a pedestal and saying we need to be like them, like, say, Trump, the Trump populism, the strong man, the reactionary tendency. So there's fights between left movements of, that they say they're communists, but some are more reactionary or not, and this guy says, the left in Venezuela has kind of lost some of this. They need to find their moral center again, be a little bit more spiritual, have its rituals. And they do have their parades and marches, and they can get a lot of quiet numbers. I mean, they're still a third of the country is solidly Chavista, as they were supportive of the government, even in its humanitarian crisis mode, because their lives have actually been improved, which is something to take into account. And it's also something to take into account when it comes to U.S. politics, of when parties say that they're doing a good job or that they're doing their best, to ask, what does that mean, your best? Whose lives have been improved? And in my lifetime, it has been very few people's lives have been improved. To say that people have been taken out of poverty is to misread the statistics or simply fudge them, as the World Bank does. As I was just watching a little counterfactual about the World Bank, anyone who says capitalism is bringing people out of poverty, there's a billion people out of poverty over the last decade because of capitalism and growth, economic growth. But really, they're quoting a World Bank stat or what the World Bank says, which is where they say a dollar a day is the poverty line. And if you make $1.50, then you're out of poverty. When really, if you actually look at a standard third world slum, you actually need $5 to actually meet your basic needs. So actually, no, billions of people are still in poverty, and that poverty is actually increasing. The last hour, I explored many different facets of kind of talking about revolution, and from changing one's mind about it to making the case for it in a slight way. There's a lot more to say, and I'm trying to be as comprehensive as possible within an hour or so. And for that, I'm going to explore this the myth-busting. Okay, this next hour is about the myth-busting of socialist states, debunking the fear of communism. But let's say a little cartoon I just saw where, you see in the movies, communism is bad. The newspapers, communism is bad. It's on TV, communism is bad. Communism is bad. Communism is bad. It's totalitarian. It's the authoritarian system. Capitalism equals freedom. Peace equals war. And so you say, oh, communism is bad. And I came to that conclusion myself. Well, I'm gonna try to break that cycle of info dependency, that reality tunnel, with what I'm going to be reading in the next hour, which are stories that are about breaking down the myths that say socialist states are less democratic. But it's also a matter of kind of defining what democracy is, and to point out how undemocratic our society, American society, really is. In your workplace, do you have a say in the decisions of your workplace? Do you have a real say in the decisions of your municipal government? Do I even have to ask, do you feel like you have a say in the national conversation? We don't even change our constitution anymore. Unlike Cuba, I'll get to that. But first, I'm going to start with a piece from Socialism Simplified, Real Life Solutions for a Decaying Capitalist Society. And its top banner is a quote from notable socialist Albert Einstein, talking in 1949. Quote, "The economic anarchy of capitalist society as it exists today is, in my opinion, the real source of evil. I'm convinced that there are only one way to eliminate these grave evils, namely through the establishment of a socialist economy." But enough with the appeals via notable authority. Although I did that by reading Pamela Anderson. Like, well, how is Pamela Anderson authority on anything? Well, I think it's because she's known as being the hot objectified woman in an 80s TV show. That makes it all the more prescient that she is now some revolutionary activist with her own foundation for training others. So the piece is called "Socialist States Are More Democratic Than Capitalist States." How can that be? Okay, well, let's go on. So this is a part two of a series. In part one, he simply makes a case, which is called "Our Right to Vote is Not a Sufficient Measure of Democracy." Do I have to go into that? Do I have to go how voting isn't really sufficient to say, oh, I have a say in government? Not with all the lobbying and money and the fact that the whole election system itself, the elections, or rather the campaigns within an election, all depend on money, a marketplace where money is speech. I don't have to go into that, do I? If I do, there's other material you can go to. This is material that you won't find anywhere else, actually making the case that socialist states are more democratic. So let's get into it. So actually existing socialist states with a single party system such as China, Cuba, and the DPRK, also known as North Korea, has been incessantly slandered for decades and called totalitarian dictatorships. The popular understanding of democracy is a country with multi-party systems, but here is the paradox of such democracy. As once pointed out by a comrade, in countries where different parties take power, the public is distracted with blaming one party or another over a lack of progress, instead of threatening the system which fails the people. In countries with a single-party system, the members of which are also elected into power, not selected by any one person, there is no other party to blame, so the single party must champion people's needs, or the very system itself will be threatened. Let us take a look at democracy and its outcomes in socialist states as a result of the changes of material conditions, meaning people's access to stuff and meeting their basic needs. First, Cuba. Cuba has made the rounds in the news recently with its new constitution draft. I'll go into more direct stories later. The Cuban constitution underwent a massive rewriting process in which more than 7,300,000 Cubans participated in about 7,234 community meetings in workplaces, in student centers, and over a period of a few months. These meetings led to 43,000 proposals for all articles of the project and over 700 changes to the Constitution. An initiative of this kind is unheard of in a developed capitalist state, where the democratic governments only serve to benefit big business. Cuba has also one of the first countries to have legalized same-gender sex. It decriminalized homosexuality in 1979, 24 years before the United States did. India decriminalized same-gender sex in 2018. Yes, just last year. So much for dictatorship, then? The new constitution draft of Cuba has also changed the definition of marriage as a union between a man and a woman to a union between spouses. I'll expand on that later. It's been stricken, but I'll get into that later. More on Cuba. The literacy rate in Cuba is nearly 100%. Healthcare in Cuba is free, one of the finest, and universal. In a world where capitalist countries are accelerating devastating climate change despite public efforts to hold government and big business accountable, Cuba is leading environmental protection, according to NASA, our own agency. Quote, undeveloped ecosystems, forests and wetlands, cover 53% of Cuba, according to an analysis of recent Landsat imagery. About 40% of the island's land surface is used for agriculture. Major crops include cabasa, tobacco, grapefruit, and sugar. Reservoirs cover about 1% of the surface of the island, and cities cover less than 1%. Despite the patchwork of farmland and pasture, Cuba is known for having relatively large stretches of pristine mangrove forests and undisturbed coral reefs, beaches, and seagrass marshes. Quote, Cuba is an ecological rarity in Latin America and the Caribbean region, said a University of Vermont remote sensing scientist Gillian Gafford in a report last year, 2018. Its complex political and economic history shows limited disturbances, extinctions, pollution, and resource depletion. The stories of Doctors Brigade of Cuba, which was selflessly worked to provide health care around the world, needs no mention. As in 2005, Cuba became the world leader in the ratio of doctors to the population, with 67 doctors per 10,000 population, as compared with 43 in the Russian Federation and 24 in the U.S. In 2014, more than 50,000 Cuban doctors were stationed around the world, including 32 African countries. Fidel Castro has helped tens of African countries with their struggles against imperialism and being colonies. If this is a dictatorship, it sure does sound a lot better than Western democracies. On to China. China, in my opinion, is the leading example of successful socialism. After 200 years of brutal imperialism by both England and Japan, which reduced China to an extremely poor, backward state, the economic growth in China has been unprecedented. The Western capitalists view China's success as a result of capitalism, and Western leftists view China as a betrayal of socialism. Get it from both sides. Both are highly mistaken in their analysis, for it is socialism with Chinese characteristics, rooted in Marxist-Leninism, which is responsible for the growth. Class struggle is highly encouraged in China, so here's an important point, especially under President Xi Jinping. Such class struggle has resulted in wages in China growing 100% from 2011 to 2018. So in the last 6-8 years, wages have doubled. How? And around the world, China, wages have only increased 1 to 2% average around the whole world. Professor Jaya Grosh recently wrote that, quote, China has augmented this effect through systematic state policies designed to improve labor conditions. Things have gotten better in China. As a result, the average nominal minimum wage in China has nearly doubled, and wages for workers in state-owned enterprises rose even faster. At the same time, the government has expanded other forms of social protections for workers, all while pursuing industrial policies geared towards boosting innovation and productivity, because it is, in fact, a planned economy. China opened its economy in 1978 to foreign investment and private business, but all while remaining socialist at its core. By not allowing banking and land ownership to be privatized, China hasn't suffered an economic depression in 4 decades, and as our experience has shown, the disease of capitalism in the form of depression and inflation is rooted in real estate and banking. Under the last government, the country is moving increasingly to the left. As of 2018, almost 2 million private companies have representation by government officials, which account for 73% of China's private sector. China's public sector makes up half of its economy and contributes 40% of GDP. In this context, it is important to mention that China has uplifted 740 million citizens out of poverty, which is a huge contribution to world poverty reduction as well. Now, the wages have increased by double because there are also now a multitude of strikes that have occurred in China. So I think moving to the left means that the Chinese government is now tolerant and almost encouraging worker strikes. Maybe we haven't heard those suicide nets stories lately because things have actually improved over the last 8 years. It would be nice if our media actually covered such things. But we don't want to give people around here any ideas, do we? So now on to the most maligned socialist state, the DPRK, People's Democratic People's Republic of Korea. Now, it's the most, but it is also the most evolved socialist state through thanks to half a century of propaganda by the West. The overwhelming majority of the world thinks that it is a horrible totalitarian country where the men are forced to have Kim Jong-un's hairstyle and most people eat grass to survive. A little context, though, to help appreciate their context there. Korea became a division before the division was ruled under Japanese imperialist forces, against whom revolutionary leader Kim Sung, grandfather of Un, fought and gained independence. The United States, as usual, interfered to subvert that revolution and enabled the division of Korea into two countries, the South ruled by a military dictator, an actual one. Carpet bombed North Korea with hundreds of thousands of bombs. 420,000 were dropped on the capital, Pyongyang itself. The population at the time was 400,000, which means a bomb was per person was dropped in the city. The bombing not only reduced the country to ashes and destroyed land, but also wiped out 20% of the population. But let's wrap up the last 2 minutes here about representation in North Korea. Pointing out that the president, supreme leader, you know, whatever you call it, is more of a spiritual slash ideology leader, not actually a person making decisions. Usually how presidents usually are in other countries, the representative of the society, while the policy, the bean counting, as it were, is done by ministers. Also pointing out that literacy in North Korea is 100%. Further, the government abolished a direct income tax of its citizens in 1974. Healthcare in the DPRK is a leading source of inspiration in other developing countries. Healthcare is entirely free as well, with one doctor for every 130 families. As the Director General Margaret Chan said, their health system would be the envy of many developing countries because of its abundance of staff. Life expectancy is around, in the mid-1950s was around 35. Now it is 72. There's also no homelessness since everyone is provided housing. And there's also theme parks, museums, and other public infrastructure, water parks, ski resorts, all also free to all citizens. If that's a dictatorship, maybe all governments should aspire to be dictatorships. And then it goes on about Soviet Union, last, certainly not least. It mostly points out that all of the economic planning there did have its top-down characteristics, but there was also massive unions as well, and people were, in fact, there. And all right, we're back. I'm going to go deep down. So now I was describing what democracy in the Soviet Union and how it existed. Just by example, just to add a little more context, outside of just saying socialism bad, capitalism good. You don't have to take it all. You can take it all face value. I'm kind of reading some stats here, which is kind of boring, but also just kind of putting things in context of just where socialist states start from being colonies where they're completely exploited and ruined and where they are now. So, talking about the Soviet Union, also called the dictatorship and Stalin a tyrant. Little do people know today that the constitution that Stalin drafted in 1936 was, in fact, the most libertarian constitution of the world at that time. Quote from Stefan Gwane's blog, linked in the article, again explains how the Soviet was more democratic than the leading Western nations. Quoting, Soviet democracy has been derided and ridiculed in the West. But let's consider the Soviet form of democracy in 1936 versus the Western form. At the time, Britain had an unelected House of Lords, as it still does, while Canada had, and continues to have, an unelected Senate. Of 500 million inhabitants of the British Empire, only 70 million, or one-seventh, lived in political democracies. South Africa denied suffrage to its black population. Aboriginal people were not allowed to vote. India had no political democracy at all and was governed by the British civil service. The U.S. denied civil rights to black citizens who lived in a state of oppression. In contrast, Suffrage in the USSR was universal, hardly the tyranny by comparison with the West that Stone and Kuznick would have us believe it was. The various people of the USSR were in fact unified. Starvation and illiteracy were unknown throughout the country. Agriculture was completely collectivized and very productive. And the records bear this out. And something to point out about the usual narratives about famine in the Soviet Union. The people reporting on these famines were journalists for the Hearst newspapers, and they basically, by the records, traveled to Moscow for a few days and then came back and then wrote their pieces about how they saw all the starvation and terrible things in the countryside. So it was all pretty much, as historical record goes, yellow journalism. Bull. Made up. I mean, were there problems? Yes. But were they to the extent of, you know, as far, if you listen to right-wing reactionary commentators, you know, YouTubers and such, they'd have you believe that the entire population of the Soviet Union died. You know, when they say 300 million, 400 million died, 500 million died. Well, that's the entire population of the country. And yet, somehow, their population increased over those years. Soviet Union was also the first non-black nation to give equal rights to black people and had created a far more secure society for minorities. The blacks in the United States were still being killed and are still killed. In conclusion, democracy in socialist states is far more successful. Socialist states are built on a Marxist ideology called the dictatorship of the proletariat. This concept has led to much confusion from the perspective of this writer. Among people who are not aware that Marx wrote in dialectics. What does that mean? So he goes into the last part of this, which is pretty important. Dialectical versus analytical thinking. So to sum it up, analytical thinking is everything is true, false statements. Either something is true or it's not. Fact or not. And a lot of confusion comes from postmodern thinking, which is to dispute this, but without kind of having a solution. So we either get stuck in everything is a little bit true or everything is believable, you become a non-skeptical person, or you just become some kind of absolutist of some kind, saying that, well, this is true, this one thing is true, and I know it to be true, so everything else must be false. The objective of analytical thinking is to render a statement true or false. Such thinking ignores both context and historical materialism of an event. Are socialist states authoritarian? Well, yes, they are. This is analytical thinking based on isolated demonstrations. But dialectical thinking, on the other hand, helps us to synthesize two opposite but equally true statements by examining the context and a totality of an event in question. That socialist states are more democratic than capitalist ones is equally true as the statement that these same socialist states were authoritarian and are. In dialectical thinking, when a question has two equally true but opposite answers, we seek to change the question. So the question here is not one of individual liberty, but of one of security. Meaning, the right to education, health care, housing, and jobs, which is what this writer has been pointing out about these states, is that they provide security rather than this liberty. What is more important? What is the priority? Quote Stalin, "It is difficult for me to imagine what personal liberty is enjoyed by an unemployed person who is about to go hungry and cannot find employment. Real liberty can exist only where exploitation has been abolished, where there is no oppression of some by others, where there is no unemployment and poverty, where a man is not haunted by the fear of being tomorrow deprived of work, home, of bread. Only in such a society is real and not paper, personal, and every other liberty possible." Quoting Stalin there. In dialectical thinking, back to the writer, the meaning of words is interpreted differently. A dictatorship, as Marxist theory goes, does not mean a ruthless, soulless dictatorship of an all-powerful person who exploits people for personal gain, a la Trump, but instead the dictatorship of a state that represents working class instead of ruling class interests, and which exercises authority only, but mostly, to keep counter-revolutions by the ruling class in check, or to fight off external aggression. Bay of Pigs, for example, in Cuba, as it works to remove economic class distinctions in society. So to point out that both are true, that these social states are authoritarian, but also more democratic, because they are providing more personal security, and thus liberty. To say that you can't have liberty without security. And truly, the most free people in society are the richest. They are free of capitalism. They can do whatever they want. So now the goal is to extend that to everyone else. Everyone else having the ability to do what they want. And the people that are against that are, we usually call, elitists, because they think everyone else, that means you, is some someone incapable of making your own decisions, of being in control of your own life and having liberty. So the very people who are in charge of this country right now, I argue, are anti-liberty, as many people on the right too point out. So on that note, since I just quoted Stalin, let me throw that over to this other piece from Business Insider, of all places. Still problematic overall as a piece, but is a conversation by James Harris called "A New Research Reveals Misconceptions About Stalin and His Quote-Unquote Great Purge." Now, this is still kind of pointing out that there was a great purge and that many people were killed. The number they're using is 750,000, which is a lot of people, compared to, but you can also compare that to other kind of death tolls of things, and the amount of people we have in prison is in the many millions, and many, many millions of others were sent to labor camps out of a population of 50 million or so. The episode has always held a macabre fascination, but there are other more substantial reasons for drawing attention to it as we reach the 80th anniversary. This is an article, well, I've read the title, I guess, but it's an article from an author of a book. It's by this historian, a mainstream kind of liberal historian, who is going to put, you know, this made up kind of liberty as opposed to liberty of sort of having security. So it's still kind of taking an anti-communist stance here. But in 1991, after the fall of the Soviet Union, and again in 2000, huge volumes of archival materials, millions of documents, were released to historians. And this is saying historians in the West. Not that there were historians in the Soviet Union, but they don't count. Real history is done by only those in capitalist countries. So, but anyway, capitalist historians got hold of the actual evidence of what was happening inside the Soviet Union and how things were actually planned, because otherwise all the narratives were pretty much made up. And that's something to take into account. That's all the narrative from our grandparents' day, our parents' day, and used for all the anti-communist propaganda. And, of course, it's not like any of that changed in our lifetime. Only with recent, this was published in summer 2016. So it's only in these years that historians in America are even considering Stalin. Maybe not complete monster. Okay. So it's taken years to digest this material and make sense of it. But new and striking findings have made it possible to rewrite the history of what has come to be known as the Terror, or the Great Purge, or again, undisciplined left-wing violence. My recent book, The Great Fear, is one example of this. So this is pushing his own book. These findings help us better understand contemporary Russia, its current authoritarian leader, meaning Putin, and reverence many Russians continue to feel for Stalin. In the West, the public perception of Stalin and the terror lingers from a period immediately after the dictator's death in 1953. His successor, and by the way, it's public perception, because that was shaped by yellow journalism. His successor, Khrushchev, wanted to limit the power of the fearsome Soviet political police, but he also wanted to communicate to the Soviet political elite that they would not be blamed for the violence of the Stalin era, though they had been deeply and directly involved. So Khrushchev blamed the terror on Stalin and his quote-unquote cult of personality, and historians in the West followed his lead. I also read a similar article just debunking, not that Stalin had a cult of personality, but that it was entirely unwanted, that he would write in personal letters that basically anyone who's making him out to be this deity, an all-powerful person, wrong, points out that there were multiple times where he wanted to step down, but it's the people under him that wouldn't let him. There was pressures that they wanted to keep this, you know, the man of steel in charge. It was a lot of work. And it's really interesting to know that about someone. It really changes your perception about this historical monster that's put in the same list as Hitler and Pol Pot. Pol Pot is not revered by any left-winger. So they're particularly following the lead of Robert Conquest in his 67 book, The Great Terror, presented Stalin as a bloodthirsty, paranoid, political opportunist determined to secure total power over all other considerations. The terror, which took place between 36 and 38, was therefore understood as a culmination of a drive to create a personal dictatorship. And if you mentioned from the previous piece, that was when the new constitution was actually drafted, which secured a lot more voting rights, suffrage, and all kinds of other protections. So it seemed like there was a lot of reaction to this constitution that needed to be suppressed. Otherwise, there was going to be another revolution or an overthrow and establishment of a different kind of dictator, one that maybe wouldn't be interested in supplying people's basic needs. So, but there are some new perspectives from this capitalist historian, or at least a Western one. Archival revelations have not, must be said, established Stalin as actually a nice guy, quite the contrary, but they have poked rather large holes in that traditional story. For example, it became clear rather early on that the majority of the victims of the terror were ordinary workers, people who presented no challenge to Stalin's power. When Stalin's private papers were released in 2000, historians initially expected to see a gap between them and Stalin's public self-presentation as a loyal follower of Lenin. So they expected him to have a different internal monologue. As Hillary Clinton would say, well, you have a public position and a private position. They expected Stalin to have a different private position. And in fact, the evidence shows he didn't. His private positions were his public positions. His motivation was to protect the revolution. The answers required a lot more digging, but it gradually became clearer and clearer that the violence of the late 30s was driven by fear. Most Bolsheviks, Stalin among them, believed that the revolutions of 1789, referring to the French one, 1848, referring to Germany, and 1871, referring to in France, Paris Commune, had failed because their leaders had adequately anticipated the ferocity of the counter-revolution reaction from the establishment. They were determined not to make the same mistake. So they created elaborate systems for gathering information on external and internal threats, but those systems were far from perfect. Undisciplined, one could say. They painted threats in a far darker colors that was warranted. So this writer kind of, the problematic point is that he still paints it as being entirely top-down. But some Marxist-Leninists, defenders of the Soviet Union, Stalin online, have pointed out via articles and evidence that I take seriously, that there were directives from the top to, and authority was given to people lower in the chain. And it was their undisciplined kind of going wild that led to the arrests of the non-reactionary. An undisciplined purge, as you know. And that Stalin, by these papers, was actually trying to issue orders to end it. To say, okay, this has gone too far. Enough damage has been caused. I think we've rounded up the people who were going to cause us problems. And things just kind of got out of his control. Because, believe it or not, in Russia at the time, lines of communication were pretty bad. And this one person controlling it all, not really feasible. And the same goes for the planning of the economy as well, which, of course, is kind of why there are some problems, bad ones. And so he points out that fear, you know, fear is the great mind killer, if you haven't heard that before. By the mid-1930s, the rise of Nazis in Germany and militarists in Japan, both sides of the U.S., on both sides of Russia, war was then on the horizon, and Stalin felt no choice but to take preemptive action against what he saw as a potential fifth column, something we in the U.S. also did, internment camps and whatnot, of Japanese citizens. But in this case, there were many people wanting to compromise with Hitler and defeat us, as it were. And because of the purge, it's argued, the Soviet Union steadfast and didn't surrender, didn't make a deal, and defeated the Nazis almost single-handedly. You know, yeah, the U.S. and Britain helped on the Western Front. But as far as the casualties and actually the fighting of the war for the longest time, that was all in the Soviet Union. So, in my other intro, I say, like, you know, there's a clip of Prager being cut up to say, you know, the communists killed mostly the Nazis. Welcome back to the last section of the Three Left Show. In the last section, I mentioned democracy in Cuba and how they have been rewriting their constitution through a bottom-up democratic process, not with representation, but with actual community meetings, many, many of them. And the numbers on the piece I'm going to read, two actual kind of journalistic pieces, from one from Telesur and the other from Reuters. About the Cuban constitution rewrite. And the numbers will be different than what I just read out in the last section. And I think this is due to the writer of the, you know, the actual journalist kind of rounding numbers. So, story, this one from Telesur. Thousands participate in crafting Cuban constitution as the process enters its final stage, ratification. Since August 13th, Over 111,000 recommendations have been made to the draft constitution during the public consultancy phase that ended this week. And this is from November of last year. Cubans will have only next week to participate in the nationwide popular consults to add to the country's draft constitution. Secretary of State Council Hermano Acosta says that since August, 100,000 Cubans have participated in public forums and have put forth some 600,000 suggestions and recommendations for the island nation's draft constitution. They have until November 15th to participate. The issues of marriage and the role of the president are among the articles with the most comments. Article 68 of the draft declares marriage as a voluntary union between two consenting people, rather than a man and a woman, opening the way for legal gay marriage. Now, as far as our American mainstream media is concerned, and this hasn't been, you know, everywhere, so the penetration of the story hasn't been very deep, but as far as my Facebook feed's concerned, all they can talk about is how gay marriage was taken out of the Constitution after being put in. So, that's all I can... As if that's the only liberty that matters, gay marriage. Now, of course it does matter. But usually what these stories miss is that it was taken out, meaning marriage is not being defined in the Constitution. Which is actually really good. Because if it's not defined by law, it means it can be anything. unless you really care about the benefits of marriage. But that's in America, where insurance and other benefits are tied, and tax structure is tied to being married. Those were put in by advocates of everyone needs to be married. Very conservative position, actually. In Cuba, where healthcare and other benefits and things are universal, you don't have to be married to get any of these things. So marriage really is then open to just whatever people want to do. And, as mentioned in this article, it's being put over to be figured out in the more exact family documents instead of the main constitution. Article 121 limits presidential terms to two consecutive runs and says that the head of state must be 60 years old when first elected and will be chosen by representatives of the popular assembly. Also getting a lot of feedback are articles that protect labor rights, access to dignified housing, dignified, not accessible, as we like to aim for here, accessible housing. Affordable, actually. No, I say accessible. Accessible means you can actually get it. Affordable means you can get it if you make enough. Not ending homelessness. And legal counsel. As with a vigilant constitution enforced since 76, their last rewrite, this draft reaffirms the socialist character of Cuba's political economy. Next, I'm going to cover that in the next piece. The current draft consists of a preamble and 224 articles, divided into 11 titles, and you don't need to know that. Yumi Rodriguez, deputy head of state council and member of the commission responsible for the drafting, says that all the recommendations will be processed and that some proposals, if not included in the document, can be crafted into bills to be voted on in referendum along with the constitution. For the first time, Cubans living abroad are able to make recommendations to the draft. So next, a story from Reuters, World News. Cuba reasserts communism in draft of new constitution, so it just zeroes in on that part. Also mentions the opening of the door to same-sex marriage by basically putting in the language about spouse. Now, I think the big news is that that's the draft, and the language for marriages between two spouses has been taken out by popular demand because many people in Cuba do go to church and are religiously conservative by way of religious belief. And it's just people's reaction. And so, but as Fidel Castro's daughter is a gay activist, there is a movement to assert those rights or to just, keep it neutral. One great goal is to have the government just be neutral on these things. Cuba has reasserted the goal of advancing toward a communist society in its draft of the country's new constitution after its removal from the first version. Because its removal from the first version of the draft sparked concern among thousands of citizens, said its state-run television. The National Assembly is this week debating a revised draft of the constitution designed to replace the Soviet-era one to better reflect the times. For example, it acknowledges private property rights and opens the door to same-sex marriage. Cuba is one of the handful of countries worldwide still run by the Communist Party and has insisted its one-party socialist system is irrevocable. That's quite biased. Well, why mention this? Still, the commission, and I mentioned earlier why that can be a good thing. If there's one party in charge, if things are going wrong, you know who to blame. It doesn't become a seesaw of, let's elect Democrats, let's elect Republicans, let's elect Democrats. And it goes back and forth and nothing ever seems to get solved. Still, the commission writing the new constitution, headed by party chief Raul Castro, took the mention of communism out of the first draft that it published in July, and then put to a nationwide consultation of 3 months, mentioned before. Thousands of citizens of community-level meetings then called for it to be reinserted, according to Cuba State Broadcaster, and as a result, it was reinserted into the draft, now under debate by the National Assembly. And I just want to point out just how blatantly disrespectful it is if you are thinking, oh, everyone in Cuba is just some brainwashed Soviet person and can't make decisions for themselves. Don't fall into that trap. It's the same trap the ruling class has, a narrative they have about you, that you cannot handle making your own decisions, that you are some brainwashed consumer of fake news. We are not that. We are better than that. We can not only be better than that, we are better than that. We just have to acknowledge that, acknowledge our own power, and we can do shit. We can do stuff. Organize. Quote, "The true revolutionary is the one who always looks to overcome the limits of the possible, and that is why we must maintain this aspiration," one lawmaker, Carlos, said, told the assembly on Thursday. The inclusion of communism is one of 760 changes to the first draft made on the back of the popular consultation. The government has insisted the drafting of the Constitution is participatory democracy at its best. You notice the reporting of Reuters is the government says it's participatory democracy and they're insisting it rather than just saying this is participatory democracy at its best. While critics point out that the fundamentals of the Cuban system were never up for discussion and say its methodology is questionable. But this is countered by the very content of this article, which is they took the aspiration to communism out, which you'd think is a fundamental conceit of a socialist state, and then by popular demand it was put back in. So it was questionable. It was questioned, and then it was affirmed. And the last line of this is, if this latest draft passes as expected, it will go to the National Assembly for a vote, and it will go to a nationwide referendum February 24th. So come up with that, and I don't know if I'll just mention that when it passes, it passes. It probably will, because, hey, it was actually determined by popular consensus. Imagine government following the direction of this popular consultation. Now, consultation isn't, you know, direct popular power by any means, but consultation is still a step above placation and making promises or just complete exclusion, which is how most decision-making occurs in our political economy life. And that's bad, people. It's bad. It's not good for us. It's bull and it's bad for us. So with that, I've come to the end of the program. Now I'll go through the housekeeping of the show. I have a Patreon for this show, The Three Lefts. And I have now my first solid patron. Woo! Fulfillment. The second Fulfillment is the name. And it's a fellow Green from Florida. Follow this show on Twitter and Facebook at Three Left Show. I will shift to also have an Instagram account. I just have my own personal one. Basically, what I've done on Twitter is turn my handle into the Three Lefts handle. So they're one and the same. On Instagram, I'd like to keep that separate, and I know I can do that. The website that has the full list of episodes that you can stream whenever you like is threelefts.news. Threelefts.news. I need to work on having separate episode pages where all the links for the sources are there. As it is now, it is just an archive page with all the episodes titled, with the file there. You can find this show, if you're listening to this live, on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and then following any other podcast app you use on your smartphone, should you have one, or via your regular desktop browser. Many ways to listen. Should I get enough patrons, via patreon.org, I will do a second episode, kind of a live stream, or just record an hour and put it on YouTube. Something of that nature. Haven't figured it out yet. I have a good amount of free time now, thanks to a shift in my work scheduling. And we'll see how that goes as time goes on. By the end of the month, I should have a definite idea of the scheduling, but certainly at the moment I can devote the entire weekend to the production and the doing of the show, which finally Okay, and I hope you all enjoy that. So this has been the Three Left Show. My profound thanks to everyone listening and anyone who takes value from this. Please give me feedback. Love it. Need it. Need to get better. Broadcasting from WCAALP, Albany, New York. I have a voice in Albany. This community-run radio station depends on community support. That community can be as broad as the entire world. All solidarity to you, and be well, and get active. Thank you very much. This has been Dan Platt. You have a good one.
I got handed an Ayn Rand sandwich straight from the can. It tasted so bland. I asked a lass to pass me a glass of Engels Conditions of the Working Class. Right away they dragged me to the committee to explain my un-American activity. They're gonna see they made a mistake if they'd only let me play my mixtape. I'm not partial to the Marshall or the plutocrats in their beaver hats, and the fascists have the athletes, but I don't care for the athletes. What I care about is music, and the communists have the music.
I hear a melody, and just as suddenly I know who I'm supposed to be.
I don't need a rationale to sing the international. I only need to plug in the headphone jack so I can listen to my backing track. I'm not jealous of the zealous or anarchics with guitar picks and